Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rusty. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Chris for inviting me up here, and he and Barb coming to get me at the airport this afternoon. If my voice cracks or pops or does anything weird, my left ear has not opened up since the flight. So I'm hearing me like ahead of myself. So it's a little weird. So if you see me start laughing, it's because something good's coming. Okay? I want to thank all of you for being so kind to me when I came in, and because I'm always really nervous whenever I go speak. I get to speak a lot of times, but I'm always nervous no matter what, because I always talk a lot about feelings. And I don't know about you guys, but the bars I drank in at the end of my drinking, we didn't talk a lot about our feelings, right? I don't remember anybody coming to me saying, you know, I woke up this morning with a lot of nameless fears. What do you think? You know, so... For me to get started, it takes me a few minutes to get started, and then, you know, then once I do, it's your problem after that. So I do have a sobriety date. It's December 9th, 1979. I just celebrated 24 years of sobriety. And I have a sponsor. It's Bob Boone from Carlsbad, California, and he has a sponsor. And I think that's very important that my sponsor has a sponsor also, and he has a sobriety date. He's been sober about 35 years now. And I have a home group. It's Friday Night San Marcos, and it's the best meeting in the world. And I hope everybody thinks that your home group is the best meeting in the world, as it should be. And if you're ever down our way, feel free to come on in and come to the meeting, and come to the meeting after the meeting when we go to coffee. And those were three things I was told I needed to have when I was new. So if you're new here tonight, and I welcome the newcomers, you need to get a sobriety date, you need a sponsor, you need a home group. And those are things that I needed. And they said, and my sponsor tells me, wherever I go to speak, I'm supposed to take that message. So, because if I don't say anything else, those are things that are important to me, that I have those things. I want to thank Chris for inviting me up. It's really an honor to get to go do anything. At the end of my drinking, the only thing I was ever asked to do was go away. And so to get asked to go anywhere is always is complete honor for me. I was born and raised in a normal alcoholic family, right? I thought everybody drank in the garage at 6 in the morning. It seemed really normal. Actually, I was born in an alcoholic neighborhood. It was really a lot of fun. There was a SWAT team was called a couple of times. And in our family, there was a lot of fighting and laughter and things going on all the time. It was sort of like Leave It to Beaver on acid, you know? It was just really kind of odd. But I loved it. And there was just, and alcohol was at the center of everything in my family. My father and my uncles and everybody and my cousins, everybody, they all drank and they're all bigger than life to me. They're all big bunch of construction workers, and I'll get into that in a little bit. And if you looked at all of us, we all look really similar. Okay, for those in the back, I used to have a lot of red hair. I have what passes for red hair. And I hated having red hair when I was growing up. I was born and raised down there in Southern California. And it seemed to me that everybody else was blonde and tan. And I can burn under a 60-watt bulb, you know. And so that didn't seem like my idea of a good time down there in Southern California. So I was, you know, right off the bat, I didn't feel like I fit in. But if you look at my family, we all look the same. There's a lot of red hair, freckles, and bad sunburns. And so, but it was an inside job. I didn't feel like I fit into that family. From the time I can remember, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. And so I always wanted to be away from that family. I always wanted to be somewhere different. And so there was a lot of that alcohol going on, you know. And there was always those drinks the morning after and everything. And I can remember the first time I thought about running away chemically, I was about 7 years old. And I don't remember why I was so frightened. But I was absolutely petrified of something. But I remember thinking, if mom would just give me one of her tranquilizers, it'll make everything okay. And that was the first time I consciously thought about running away chemically. Now, my mom's been in Al-Anon a lot of years. And the first time I told that story at a meeting, I forgot to mention she didn't give me the tranquilizers, which seems to be very important to her for some reason. So, So she didn't give me the tranquilizers, you know. But what I always felt growing up was that fear. And I didn't know till I came to this program that what I was feeling, I always felt fear and anger. And I didn't know they went hand in hand. I was told early on in my sobriety that unresolved fear manifests itself in anger. And I did not know that. I thought they were completely separate emotions. And what I found out when I got here was that my fear, which I just kept tamping down and tamping down because I never talked to anybody about it. I couldn't tell my family. Couldn't tell my father I was scared to death. You know, there was like John Wayne syndrome going on in our family. You didn't talk about anything. You didn't talk about being afraid. So I never told anybody about being afraid. And I just kept tamping it down. And ultimately what happened is it came out as anger. And that anger was always based on my fear. And I didn't know that till I got here to this program. And that's where it came from. But I was always, I was that scared to death little kid, you know. And there was always that booze around our house in the morning. And, you know, you'd be, you know, you're a little kid and you're sipping on it. And, you know, sometimes you get a cigarette butt and you swallow it or you spit it out, one or the other, you know. It's kind of chance you take as a budding little alcoholic, you know. But, but the first time I got drunk, I was about 13 years old. And my brother and I were down the street at the widow's house. The widow was a 32-year-old blonde woman. Sort of having a little private moment here. So we're down the street at the widow's house, and we're drinking, right? I get down there, and I remember Clancy, Mike and I were talking about it at dinner tonight, and Clancy talks about that knot, that just that knot of fear, and the wind could blow through it, and that knot of fear was always sitting there. And I got down in there that night, and I drank, you know, and that first drink went down, and it started smoothing out that knot of fear, you know, and I all of a sudden, everything changed for me immediately, you know. I became very philosophical, and I began to dance, and I got very romantic, although I was alone at the time that happened. I did all those things. I got a tan that night. It was incredible what happened that night. My whole life changed, you know, because alcohol did things for me that I couldn't do for myself. And so I'm drinking, and that's with the first drink, right? That's with the first beer. And my alcoholic mind immediately says, man, if I feel good with one, imagine what 21 is going to make me feel like, you know? And so that's what I was striving for. And so I tried to drink it as much as I could. And the rest of the time I drank, I searched for that feeling all the time. And I'd see it go by. You know, it's like, ooh, there it goes. You know, Cliff talks about that, you know, 7 seconds of serenity, you know, in drinking. And I understood that immediately when he talked about that. Because that's what I always searched for after that, was that 7 seconds of feeling good, feeling like I fit into the world for the first time, you know. And a lot of things happened that night also. I had a blackout, got into trouble. My father caught us, and my father came running down there in his underwear, which is a scary enough proposition in and of itself. And catches, and my father's an alcoholic, and I'll get into that in a little bit later, but he catches my brother and I, and as a punishment, he takes us home that night, and he doesn't do anything that night because we're drunk, we're not going to remember anything. Our punishment is the next morning, we're up at dawn, we're supposed to clean the kitchen the kitchen ceiling, right? And there's grease is dripping in my face, and it was horrible. I was so hungover, I was so sick, and as a punishment, it worked really well. I hated grease for a long time, right? But you couldn't stop the way I felt about alcohol. I was punished a lot in my drinking. I went to jail. I did a lot of things, and I was punished a lot. But you couldn't take away the way I felt about it. Because for once in my life, I found something that made me feel okay. And I kept going back to that all the time. And that was my drinking. And you know, the best definition of insanity I ever heard was doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And that's what I always did. I always expected it to be different. Now, I'd like to tell you that when I went into high school at the age of 14, that I was, you know, drinking all the time and in bars with false IDs and everything, but I'd be lying to you if I did that. You know, at the age of 14, when I went into high school, I was 4 feet 10 inches tall. I weighed 86 pounds. And I had like one hair in my armpit. I was like a girl magnet right there, you know. And I'm in, you know, I'm in with these behemoths, you know, in school there. And I'm in gym, and the first time, you know, everybody's, all the guys are supposed to be taking a shower, and I'm looking at, like, my one hair, and I'm thinking, you know, one more time, I don't fit in someplace. Now, I know a lot of people talk about high school, a lot of fond remembrances. I just wanted to survive that place, you know. I just wanted to get through it because I was scared to death of all those people. I remember my freshman year, first couple weeks, they had this freshman dance that we could get to know each other, you know, all fit in and everything. So I go to this dance. I'm going to play your games, you know, and I'll go to this dance. And I'm standing around one side of the room with a bunch of other guys, and I'm looking across the floor at Betty, who's absolutely gorgeous. And I'd like to go ask Betty to dance, but I'm afraid if I go over across the room to ask Betty to dance, she's going to say no, and I'm going to have to walk back across the floor, and she's going to be laughing with all of her girlfriends at me, and I'm going to be totally humiliated and probably have to go outside and kill myself. That's what goes through my brain. I don't even move my feet, and Betty doesn't even know I'm alive, right? A friend says, come on outside. We got some peppermint schnapps. I go out, and I drink that peppermint schnapps. And like it talks about in our big book, that magical transformation took place. Well, I walked back in there, and I looked around and said, okay, who gets to dance with me now, you know? It was a totally different human being walked back in under the influence of alcohol. And I began to dance that night, although I'm paraphrasing dancing. I didn't find out till after I was sober. I didn't know how to dance. Although I did it with great enthusiasm, I was told, and had a good time. And the next morning, I woke up, or I came to, I should say, and that knot of fear was there, because I knew I had done something. And now I had a lot of well-meaning family and friends in my life who loved to tell me the things that I had done the night before. And they said, boy, you had a great time. Now, maybe that would sound good to some normal person that, wow, you had a great time the night before. To me, that was humiliating. I didn't know what to think because I couldn't remember what I did, you know, and it scared me. And for the next 4 years, excuse me, for the next 4 years of high school, I just attempted to survive it, and I just tried to be as inconspicuous as I could. Although when you have flaming red hair and a big old afro, it's kind of hard to be inconspicuous. And I love drinking. I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, wherever I could. You know, if somebody said, we got something, it didn't matter what you got. You know, I'm going. And we're drinking. Because I didn't want to be me. I remember the first time after I was sober for a while and I woke up and the first thought was, I don't want to be anybody else. It was such a godsend to me because every morning I woke up wanting to be somebody different. And now I can wake up thinking, I don't want to be anybody else. I just want to be who I am. And that's a relief, you know, that's a freedom from this program for me. But I'm in high school, I just don't want to be there. You know, everybody else is going to the beach, and whenever I go to the beach, they didn't have like regular sunscreen back then. They had that, you know, oxide crap that would put it all over your nose and ears and, one more time, I'm really like attracting them, you know, and it was horrible. I know you feel sorry for me too later, but yeah, it was horrible, you know, and I just hated it. But there was, you know, and I know it was the late 60s when I went to school, so there was a lot of other chemicals, but I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol is my drug of choice. That's what I always did, was drank. And I used some other things, but that isn't a part of my disease process. What is for me is drinking. Is alcohol, because I always went back to it. I always drank as often as I could. So I got out of high school finally, much to my relief, much to my parents' relief, and I'd always wanted to go off to college. I remember at the beginning I told you that my brother or my dad and my uncles, everybody, they were all very good with their hands. They're all good construction workers, and they're really bright in that regard, and they can do those things inherently. You know where it says, like you open the package, it says installs in seconds? They actually do that sort of thing. I'm still looking at the package 3 days later, you know, and trying to figure out what it is. So I couldn't put two boards together, essentially. So my great thought was I've always wanted to get into medicine because I have an aunt who worked in the emergency room. And so my alcoholic thinking was if I can't fix boards, I'll try to fix people. There's a keen alcoholic thought if you think about it, you know. So I tried to go off to school. My biggest mistake when I went off to school is I took me with me. Huge mistake, because I took me and my perfectionism, and in order to be equal to you, I had to be 10 times better than you. I can never just be equal to anybody. I had to be 10 times better than you were, and I can never measure up to my own standards. So when I got into school and I wasn't tops in the class and I wasn't doing the best I could possibly do, it was really devastating to me. And I do what I do really well, which is crawl into a bottle and try to run away. For the next couple of years of school, I did nothing but party and didn't do much in the way of school because it was an excuse for me. I just wanted a drink. I just wanted to hide away. Because if you saw the real me, you would see a loser. That's the way I looked at myself. I had this big L in the middle of my forehead is the way I felt. And I'm just some loser who doesn't know how to do anything. I don't know how to do life. I don't know how to be around people. And I did what I do well, and I ran away finally from school, and I went back to where my parents were. And I went to work for my father and his company, and he protected me, and I became a protected alcoholic for the next few years. And by a protected alcoholic, I mean if I didn't show up for work on Monday because I was too hungover, it was okay. I was the boss's son. And if I didn't show up on Tuesday, it was okay because I was the boss's son. And if I went home early on Friday because I had a very difficult Wednesday and Thursday, it's okay because I was the boss's son, you know. I was almost protected to death in my early alcoholism. And there was a lot of times in there. And by this time, I'd become a very shallow person. When you're completely afraid like I was, and I was so wrapped up in who I was, all I ever thought about was me. Occasionally, I thought about you thinking about me, but mostly I just thought about me, right? And I was very shallow. And I only thought about that. And so when you're only shallow, you become I would look at everybody else's outsides. I'd look at you guys, just a room like this, and say, you guys know how to dress. You know how to act. You know how to do everything. I don't know how to do that. I remember when I first came to this program, I heard about incomprehensible demoralization. I understood it inherently. And I'll tell you an example of that. In 1976, I was going to a wedding in Los Angeles. Now, I'm thinking I want to at least look good. I don't feel good inside, but I'm going to look good, right? No matter what, you got to look good. So I go to this wedding in 1976, and I had on a powder blue leisure suit. Big old collars, my big red hair, right? Collars out the ear, big tall shoes. And I weighed like 125 pounds, right? My friend said, you put a yellow raincoat on me, I look like a number two pencil. And we go to this wedding, and I'm looking so good in this suit, right? And the next thing, I'm coming out of a blackout. We're coming south on Interstate 5 by San Onofre, which is a big power plant down there in North San Diego County. And we're coming south, and I'm saying to my brother, slow down or let me out. Then he laughs, which for us is fighting terms. And then I said, seriously, slow down or let me out. So he stopped, so I can call a bluff, so I got out. And then he sped off. Now I'm standing there really perplexed, but looking good in that powder blue leisure suit, right? So I stick my thumb out, and the guy in the Volkswagen skids to a stop, so I get in, and we start racing down the freeway. Now, the guy in the Volkswagen is twice as drunk as my brother. And then I see my brother backing up on the freeway, and I wave to him, although he claims to this day that I wave to him with one finger. But I wave to him as we go by. And one more time, I get home, and I pass out. And when I came to the next morning, I did what I always did. It was that ritual of looking at myself. Was there any blood on me? What did my car look like? How did I look? So when I came to that next morning, I had that suit on that I'd had on at that wedding, and when I thought I looked so good the whole time. And what I came to find out was that I had the coat on inside out the whole time. And my first thought was, oh my God, I can't go back to Los Angeles. I'd only been a real small part of L.A., but L.A. was out. I didn't go back for a long time. Because once again, I didn't see the humor in it that I find now. What I saw was that I was a loser. You know? That one more time, everybody could see what a loser I was and how, you know, my self-worth just kept going down and down. So when I came here and they talked about incomprehensible demoralization, I really understood it. You know? And by this time, I'm working for my dad, and I'm having a lot of blackouts, and I'm just getting in a lot of trouble. You know, nothing's going right. And I remember going to my mom and saying to her, you know, I wish I could do something. You know, things could get better. I was a world-class whiner, and I know you're all surprised to hear that, but I was a world-class whiner, and I just whined about everything. And I wish things could be different, because what I did was try to put a Band-Aid on everything. If I had a better job, if I had a better car, if she was better, if they were better friends, the whole litany of things I would say. And I said, I don't know what to do. What should I do? So she threw some ideas out, like, you know, maybe change jobs. I didn't want to do that. And she said, maybe try school. And that seemed too hard, and I didn't want to try that. Then she said the magical words to me. Well, maybe if you got married. It's like, great. So I went looking for her. And I really, what I went looking for was a hostage, right? I wasn't looking for a marriage. I was looking for a hostage. And I found I met a woman from Massachusetts who just moved out here from a bad relationship. And we knew each other about 6 weeks, and we got married. And my mom was right. I settled down for like 12 hours, right? Because the problem was I brought me to the relationship one more time. And for the next 4.5 years of this marriage, it was based on my alcoholism and her fear. And if you had said to me, do you love your wife? I would have said, sure. But if you said, how do you feel about her? I couldn't tell you because I didn't know how to feel about anything. I didn't like me, so why would I like anybody else? I didn't know how to feel. So we started this relationship and based on alcoholism. By this time, I was drinking in the bars a lot, and a lot of anger was beginning to come out of me. I have this genius for really ticking off the biggest guy in any place I'm in, right? When I'm in a bar, I thought it was witty repartee, right? I'm a smartass, is what it was. And I would just tick, and I'm going to paraphrase fights here because I lost every fight I was ever in. I got beat up a lot, okay? Because 125 pounds, you just get beat up. And I was constantly getting pounded on. And I'm here to tell you, if you don't think they'll hit a guy with glasses, I am living proof that they will. They wrap my glasses around my head all the time. And that anger was just seething out of me all the time. And I didn't know what I was angry at. I just seemed to be angry at the world. And when I wasn't drinking, though, I was that scared little kid. And my wife and I started this relationship for the next 4.5 years. And it was based on all that. And I wish I could tell you more stories, but I was a blackout drinker, so I don't remember much of anything except what some people have told me. I remember being in a bar one time, biggest insult I ever got. I was standing there saying something to somebody, all 125 pounds of me, and he said, geez, you're like a talking stick, you know? It was insulting, but it was accurate, you know, but it was like, so after he got done beating me up, you know, I was like, okay. So we were in this relationship, and on June 11th, 1978, my daughter was born. And the first time in my life, I thought I did something good. First time. But you know what? I put that little girl in harm's way because of my drinking. I came out of a blackout when she was about 14 months old, right before I got sober. And I'm speeding down the freeway, and she's just in the back seat. She's not in the car seat. She's not restrained at all. And my thought was, oh, my gosh, I could get my baby hurt. But you know the insanity of our disease is? It didn't stop me. I was doing it again. Fortunately for me, my God watched over her when I couldn't do it. Because I was incapable of being a father. I was incapable of watching over that little baby. And God watched her for me. And I began to drink at home pretty much in earnest the last year of my drinking because I'd been arrested a couple times. And that really frightened me to be in the jail. Being in the drunk tank, although if you heard me tell you about it, I was in charge of the cell block, you know, that grandiose alcoholic thinking going on still. But I'm scared to death, and I began to drink at home in earnest. And last year of my drinking, I'd become an abusive individual, verbally and physically, toward my wife. I wasn't toward my daughter, but I wasn't there as a father either, you know. I wasn't much of a person. But on December 8, 1979, I'd come out of a blackout, and I'd been abusing my wife one more time. And fortunately for me, she called my mom. Because when I came out of that blackout, I can't remember what I said. I said something about, I need to do something. Please, God, help me. And she called my mother. And my mom was one of the last people still talking to me because my father didn't want anything to do with me and the rest of my family. Because when you're a liar, a cheat, and a thief, and you're always wanting to hit somebody, people don't want to be around you anymore. But fortunately for me, my mom was still there. And I thank her from the podium every year. when I take a kick. She didn't think I was a throwaway person. And she came down there and talked to me. And she said, you got to do something. You got to go see a psychiatrist. You got to go to AA. You got to do something. And we've talked subsequently. And she doesn't know why she said go to AA. She doesn't know why she said that. Because we didn't have any members of our family in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. And I said I would call Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'd like to tell you that I chose AA for really spiritual reasons that night. But my thinking was, if I call a psychiatrist and it doesn't work, and it like costs like, what, $75 an hour, and I'm going to need that money to drink, and I've heard AA is like something, what, a buck a meeting, you know? I mean, I wish I could be more spiritual for you guys, but the buck a meeting really attracted me, you know? And I called Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And I'm going to tell you a part of my story that I love to talk about, because I think we don't get to do enough of it anymore. Is that when I talked to this guy named Bernie O'Kelly, he's a big Irish guy, and he's been sober a long time. He's been sober like 35 years now. He knew the guy named Larry D agreed to come out to my house that Saturday night, and it was raining and cold. Raining, not as cold as this, but it was raining out there, you know. And fortunately for me, they were very persistent because I couldn't quite remember how to get to my own house when I gave them the directions the first time. I just drove there. I didn't know how to get there. And they called back, and they talked to my mom, and she gave them the directions, and they came over. They knew that still impresses me to this day that those two men came out late on a Saturday night and reaching out the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to an alcoholic who was suffering. That impresses me to this day that those men did that. They were doing that 12-step call. And they came and they began to talk. And anybody who knows Bernie knows he loves to talk, right? And I don't know what we talked about that night, but I don't think I need to know. You know? I don't need to know. All I need to know is they were there. You know? And they came and we talked, and they said to be back the next morning and take me to my first meeting. That was December 9th of 1979. It's my sobriety date. I've been sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Through no great wisdom of my own, I got out of my way and I let the people in this program show me the way. And through a loving and merciful God, I've been able to be sober since then. And they showed up that next morning in Larry's truck that had no shocks. And they put me right in the middle. And we went off to this meeting, and Bernie brought this jelly donut with, like, grape jelly in it. And periodically, he'd wave it under my nose, and he'd squeeze it a little bit, and he'd go, jelly donut? And I said something really smart, like, I don't eat. You know? And they would laugh. They thought that was so fun, you know, and I was so sick. And Mike and I were talking about it at dinner about the whole time I was doing things. And I couldn't wait to get to that meeting because they were talking to me about, you know, bacon and greasy eggs, their favorite rat. I'm like, oh, I got to get out of this truck. And I found out later it was a sport with all of them. You know, it's like, let's antagonize the newcomer. You know, I was 25 years old. I was a lot younger than most of them there at the meeting. A lot of them were old, in my opinion, although they're the same age I am now, so they weren't old. I got to that meeting, and it was the old Shadow Ridge meeting on a Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, and I got out of that truck, and there was a whole bunch of people standing out there, and they were smiling, and they were happy to see me, and they were saying, welcome, we keep coming back. And after a short time, my ego took over, and I was like, well, what else can I do for these poor people, you know? And I didn't know they told everybody that. Jeez, you know, I was like, they were telling all the newcomers keep coming back. I remember what I really remember about my first meeting was teeth. There were a lot of teeth. You know, hi, how you doing? I'm really watching you. Like, jeez, there's a lot of teeth. And my toothbrush got within about, 6 inches of my face. I was pretty happy a lot of times. So I remember going into that meeting, and a guy named Cliff Roach came over, and he said, would you like some coffee? And I said, I'd love some coffee. And I remember his laugh being something like, hey, and he brings me back this cup filled to the brim. And I'm shaking. I shake it all over my hand and everything. And I look over. There's this knot of old-timers standing over here. And they're all laughing uproariously. And another one breaks free from the pack and comes over and says, more coffee? And I caught on after the fourth cup. I was burning up, right? I was like, no, ice cubes would be wonderful right now, but I couldn't. And so they said they're going to start the meeting, and Bernie and Larry sat me down between them. I couldn't get away from those two guys, and it was back in, and I really liked the way they did it back then, you know, is that, and I try to do it at the meetings I go to and the guys I sponsor, is that when somebody was new, we told them what the meeting was about, and that's what they did. They told me what the meeting was about. They didn't assume that I knew what was going on. I didn't know anything, you know. I didn't know a participation meeting from a speaker meeting. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know a closed meeting from an open meeting. So they talked to me about those things. And Bernie said something to me that morning that has stuck with me, and these are my opinions for the newcomers. These are my opinions from the podium. And he said to me that morning, he said, you know, they're going to ask for newcomers in the first 30 days. If you're an alcoholic, you need to raise your hand and identify yourself as such. Now, I'd had almost 4 cups of coffee in me now, and I was beginning to wake up. And I said to Bernie, I've been thinking, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. And Bernie said to me, you know, only an alcoholic wonders if he's an alcoholic. I don't know about the rest of you guys. They always spoke to me in code, and nobody ever gave me a code book. They said things like, if you come to this meeting and make coffee, you'll get to stay sober. And I'd think, what the hell does that mean? I make coffee every morning. I haven't been sober yet. Didn't make any sense. But all I said was, oh. You don't want to look bad, right? Bernie said to me one day, I want you to beware of the seemingly good and the seemingly bad. Good is good, burn, bad is bad. Come on, get it together here, pal. But all I said was, huh. So when he said, only an alcoholic wonders he's an alcoholic, I just said, huh. So I raised my hand and identified myself as an alcoholic, and I've been one to this day. Haven't found it necessary to take a vacation or sabbatical from being an alcoholic. I've been an alcoholic ever since then for the last 24 years. And they started that meeting, and they were talking. People were talking about things. It was incredible what they were talking about. And then a lady took a 3-year cake, and I'm going to tell you, they sang just as bad back then as they do now. And I was, and for like a nanosecond, I was happy for her because she appeared to be really happy about this 3-year thing she had going on. It seemed like way beyond anything I could ever do. 3 years seemed like an awful long time. And congratulations to all the birthday people tonight. But that meeting ended, and they did what they were taught to do and what our book talks about. As they took me over to Larry's house, and they fed me lunch, and they began to talk, as only one alcoholic can talk to another alcoholic. And they began to talk to me about their fears and about the anger and all those things they had done in their life. And I'm thinking, they've been watching me. They know about me. And the reality was, they were just telling their stories to me, as only one alcoholic can do. And I like when there's always a pause on the tape. It's always good. Speaking to the 800 people, that's just for the tape. You got to amuse yourself sometimes, okay? So anyway, they're talking. And like I said, I did a lot of listening. I wasn't allowed to talk a lot when I was new. And they talked. And I went home that night, and they bought me a big book. And I remember I went home, and I did all 12 steps. I'm a good reader. I can do that thing. That fourth thing seemed a little odd, but, you know, but I did it. And I did those steps, and I went to sleep. And the next morning, I woke up. And I really woke up, and that knot of fear is just still sitting there. And my first thought was, oh, my God, what have I done? I've committed myself to AA. And they were coming back. Make no mistake about it. They were coming back. They flat told me, be on your porch. I thought the first step was shut up and get in for a long time, right? And you know, I'm thinking, my God, I've committed myself to AA. What am I going to do? What are the neighbors going to think? The neighbors could care less, right? As long as I wasn't parking in their driveway anymore, you know? And I went off to these meetings. And you know, I'd like to tell the newcomers now that from then on, everything became wonderful. I became independently wealthy, and things just became magnificent. But I'd be lying to you once again. First 10 months of my sobriety, I didn't do much around here except show up. I was... constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And those steps seemed awfully hard. But what saved my life were commitments and going to those meetings. I was just happy to be going places where they wanted me back, you know, because I was getting that, I was clearing up a little bit, and I was like, I liked being around people. And the commitment saved me, but I didn't make commitments for all the best reasons. We have a Saturday night meeting down in San Marcos. At that time, it was a junior high school, and there was about 250 to 300 people went there every Saturday night. And they had this greeting line from hell, stretched both lines of a walkway. It was like running a gauntlet. And they all wanted to shake your hand or hug you or kiss you or whatever, and I didn't want any part of it because I didn't want to be around people that much. And a guy named Rick L. said, you know, we need somebody to come make coffee at this meeting, so why don't you come make a commitment? And I said, well, what time do I have to be there? Back then it was an 8:30 meeting, and he said, you have to be here at 6:30 to make the coffee. I said, great, I'll miss that greeting line, right? And so I kept that commitment for the next 4 years just to get out of that greeting line. But it got me going to that meeting all 4 years, and I was there making coffee. If I can't do anything else in the world, I can make a lot of coffee in a pinch, right, because of this program. But it also taught me, because, you know, you're there at 6:30 and you're all set up by 7:15. And I was watching tonight all these people setting up and everything. As you get done, you see knots of people standing around talking. And I began to talk, and I began to be okay with who I was. You know, I began to like the person I was starting to become. I didn't know who that was or what that was going to be. But there was that, I was starting to make that little bit of a transformation and began to talking to people. And, you know, for the first 10 months, I didn't do much around here, putting a band-aid on. I'm going to tell you about a turning point for me. At 10 months of sobriety, my wife divorced me, and I got fired from my job. And I thought, wow, this AA is working good. One of those seemingly good, seemingly bad things. You know, my wife divorced me because I was a terrible husband, and our relationship was over, and I don't blame her. And I'm going to tell you today, my ex-wife Diane and I are very close because of this program. And because I was able to make amends to her, make a living amends to her. Now, I was an apologizer by nature, meaning I would apologize for anything if it got me out of trouble. I'd apologize for Lindbergh kidnapping if it got me out of trouble. It didn't mean anything. They were just words. I just said, I'm sorry until you weren't mad at me anymore, and then I would just repeat the same thing, part of the insanity. So when I went to her when I first got sober and I said, I'm really sorry, she said, I really don't want to hear that. You say that all the time. I want to see some actions. What are your actions here? And I had to change the person I became. And, you know, when we divorced, we had that daughter, and I got to be a single dad because of this program. I learned how to be a father right then and there. And it was only because of this program that Diane would allow me to have that. She wouldn't have done that otherwise. And I got fired from my job because I was a bad employee. There's the bottom line. I remember when they first fired me, though, I walked in there and said, gee, you know, you don't understand. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they said, we don't care. They could care less. I was a bad employee. I was missing all that time. And then when I was new, I remember going to Bernie one night. I said, boy, I really like some of that serenity you've been talking about. He said, you know, if you'd quit drinking 20 cups of coffee and smoking 2-pack cigarettes before the meeting starts, you might actually get a little serenity in your life. I was banging off the walls, man. Me and the other newcomers were all over huddled around the coffee pot. And the meeting had ended at 10, and we'd be like, where's everybody going, you know? It's like, it's just starting. Caffeined out. So I was a bad employee, so I got fired. And it seemed like those are the seemingly good, seemingly bad things in the world. And it seemed like bad things. Turned out to be the best things that ever happened to me. I'd been telling my sponsor, you know, gosh, I'd really like to go back to school. I really would like to go back to school, but gosh darn it, I don't have any time. I got a job and I got a wife. I just don't have any time for it. The reality was my fear was stopping me from doing it. I just made those excuses. My fear sat there and wouldn't allow me to proceed. But he remembered that. If you're new and you tell your sponsor something, they're going to remember it, okay, as a good sponsor should. So when I went whining to him, hoping that he would give me some sympathy and everything, he just laughed and said, you know, you've been wanting to go to school, so here's your opportunity. And I did. I went back to school, and I got into profession. I actually am in medicine. I work in the emergency room as the senior technician now down where I live, and I've been there for 21 years. And I love my job, and I was telling Mike on the way over here that I see our disease in action on a daily basis, what it does to us, what it does to people around us. And it's an ongoing thing. And I get to see every day what happens. You know? And I love my job. You know? And so it seemed like a bad thing that I got fired. It seemed like a bad thing that my wife divorced me. But, you know, I needed to grow up around here. I needed to get some maturity. One of the first things I ever related to in this program was Cliff Roach was talking, and he said that he talked to his sponsor, Bill, and he said to Bill, "Bill, you don't understand. I'm really sensitive." And I always thought I was a sensitive person. And Bill said to him, "You're not sensitive. You're an immature SOB. And I went, "Oh." One more time. And then I needed to start to grow up. And what happened at that 10 months is that I was just, you know, I'm fired and my wife is gone and I'm feeling sorry for myself and I'm whining. And now there was a Halloween dance going on. And this is in October 1980. They're having a Halloween dance. And I made some friends by this time during commitments. And they called me up and said, "Come on over and come to the dance and we'll take care of you." I said, "No, I don't want to go. I just want to stay home." They said, "Come to the dance." And I said, "I don't have anything to put on. Just leave me alone." They said, "Just put something on and come to the dance." I said, "All right, I'll come to the dance." So I had a check shirt and a little bandana I put on and jeans. I thought I looked like John Wayne as I walked out the door. Could hear my spurs jangling as I walked, you know, like that kind of thing. So I go off to this dance and I'm feeling low, you know, about myself. And I get them walking up and there's a whole bunch of people from the program and they're all like dressed in silly costumes. And as I walked up, they all began to sing the Howdy Doody song to me. Which totally burst my bubble, but I began to laugh for once. You know, the only laughter in my life had been real maniacal laughter on my part up to that point. I hadn't laughed, and I began to laugh, and it came out of my gut, you know, and it came out of my soul, and I began to laugh a little bit, and I started to laugh at myself. And I learned around here how to not take myself so seriously, but I take my program deadly seriously. And I began to laugh and to have fun in this program. And, you know, if it hadn't been for that, I don't know where I'd be today. You know, I went to work at the hospital. I met my wife there, my wife Julie, who sends her regards. And we've been married now for almost 22 years. And I have a wonderful, loving relationship with that woman. She's been in Al-Anon a long time, so I get released on a daily basis. Which is good. But we have this program in our life. And there's a lot of laughter. And I don't work her program, and she doesn't work my program. And we have lots of parties at our home. When I had 20 years, they had a party for me. And this still really gets me. But they had a 20-year party. And they had the party where I went to my very first meeting at that clubhouse. And there was about 250 people there for this 20-year party for me. And the cake was shaped like Howdy Doody. And when they sang, they didn't sing Happy Birthday. They sang the Howdy Doody song again, you know. Because I had learned how to be loved, and I learned how to love other people through this program. And that little girl that I had put in harm's way is now 25 years old, and she's pregnant with our first grandchild, and she's due in January. And I'm having a grandson, and I'm going to spoil the hell out of him. That's all there is to it. But I could have missed all of that. You know, I absolutely could have missed the fact that that little girl would grow up. Now, I'm not saying she was this perfect kid growing up. She was far from it. There's a lot of ism running around in her still, I think. At 15, she had blue hair. It was a lovely shade of blue with everything she wore. I understand about how I wanted a different hair color. I'd take any hair at this point in time, you know, but but that kid, I've learned how to love my children and be loved. And most kids know that they are loved all the time. And there's a lot of laughter going on there. And at 15 months of sobriety, I was living, you know, part of that seemingly bad thing again. I moved back in with my parents. You know, I'm 27 years old. And I'm living at home with mom and dad thinking, wow, I am on the high road to AA success right now. You know, right? I am just on it. You know? Seemed like one of those bad things. And one night I got up to go to a meeting. My dad had been watching me from the garage where he did all his drinking. And one night I got up to go to a meeting, and he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to a meeting." And he said, "Can I go with you?" And I said, "Yeah." And it really frightened me, and I called Larry, and he said, "Just bring him to the meeting. We'll take care of him." And that was in March of 81. My father has 22 years of sobriety now. You know? And I got to tell you, having a dad as a newcomer was a lot of fun. Like, more coffee, Dad? But I learned that my father, who I was so intimidated by and that I thought knew more than anything, had the same fears that I do. And we were the same. We're two alcoholics just trying to be sober. We go to the same Friday night meeting. We get to talk. We have dinner together. And I love my father. You know, I absolutely love my dad. And we get a chance to talk. And he hates podiums. He hates them. But he's great on the phones. He's always working with central office, talking to other alcoholics on the phone. That's his niche. He loves that stuff. He just hates being on a podium because he doesn't think he speaks very well. But he speaks very well about this program. You know, and I've gone through a lot of stuff around this program because of that. I remember I said to them early on, you know, what about this hand of AA? When's it going to reach out and help me? And they said, you know, the hand of AA is at the end of your arm. It was one of more of those things of saying, huh? I didn't know what they were talking about. But for me, it's to give back. I have to be able to give back what was so freely given to me. And that means opening my home up. When I have we have parties at our house, and I sponsor a lot of men, and I go to a lot of meetings, and when I'm asked to go do something, I go do it. You know, a lot of times if I'm asked to go speak in the middle of the week, late at night, it doesn't matter. I'm going to go do it because that's what they taught me to do. They said, if I want to be sober, I'm going to be willing to do anything to stay sober. And I am willing to do anything to be sober. And my sobriety is number one, and my wife understands that. She knows that my sobriety has to come first, because without it, I have nothing. And I began to teach here in 1988. I began to teach EMTs at the college, which was a gift, again, from God, because I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I didn't know how to impart any knowledge. And now I'm an adjunct professor at Palomar College, along with my job in the emergency room. And I love getting to teach the kids. I really love it. I remember when I was first teaching, I said to somebody, I'm really nervous. What do I say? And he goes, say what you want. They're only going to know what you tell them. So, now you know the secrets to being a professor, huh? But you know, at that 10 months when I thought everything was so bleak and the world was coming down around my ears, I did the thing that I've been taught to do the most, is I got into the steps. And I had to get into the steps. And I went to my sponsor and we began to work them in earnest for the first time in my sobriety. And when we got to that third step, he said, you know, if you do this third step and you absolutely mean it and you turn your will and your life over the care of a higher power as you understand him, that fear and that anger will go away. Because what you're saying is you're willing to take things as they come. He said, you can't use him as a Bush League pinch hitter. You can't use him only on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. This has to be all the time. So you need to go into this with this understanding. And I did, and I've been able to turn my will and my life over the care of God as I understand him in that third step. And he's right, that fear and that anger began to go away. Slowly at times, but it did happen. Because there was always those times when I wanted to reach in and start helping out. You know, I wanted to mix it up because I wasn't getting what I wanted. But too many times over the years, I've seen things that didn't seem like they were very good turn out to be the best things that ever happened to me, and vice versa for other people. You know, and I learned through these steps, because I can make amends, and I made amends to the people, and the promises came true for me. And I know the promises have been pointed out to me. They come after the ninth step. They don't come after the first or second step. After the ninth step, and that if I work these steps, the promises will begin to come true. Because that whole thing about, you know, property, power, and prestige, that seemed pretty good, man. I was willing for that. But I needed to do some things first. And once I began to work these steps in earnest in my life changed. I enjoy being a redhead. I wish I had more, you know? I don't mind not getting a tan. I went to Mazatlan and actually wore shorts, which almost started an international incident, but I wore shorts, right? I don't wear shorts. I mean, that's not something I do, but I did at that time because I was able to step out of myself. And I began to laugh more and more. There was a time, I remember when I was new. If you're new and you're going to hear some laughter sometimes, it's going to seem cruel, but it helped me more than anything. And I'll give you an example of that. Bernie, One time this young guy got up at the podium, and he was really whining about his day. He said, God, he got up in the morning, his hair wouldn't work right, he had bad hair, and his job was terrible, his wife was rotten to him, and to top everything off, he went to Coco's that night, and he lost $10. I was like, oh, it's terrible. Bernie got called on next. Bernie got up there and said, wonderful day, had a great hair day, his wife was nice, his job was great, and to top it off, he went to Coco's and found $10. And I remember I was really new, and I'm thinking, I want to laugh, but I don't want to laugh at the guy, you know. But then I saw the new guy. He was smiling, and he knew it was okay, you know, that it's all in your perception of what goes on. I love this program. I love being sober. And I love the fact that I get to go places and meet new people and get to do different things. So again, I want to thank Chris for inviting me up to speak tonight. I want to thank all of you for being here. If you're new and you didn't hear anything you related to, go to a meeting tomorrow night. If you don't hear anything tomorrow night, go to the meeting the next night. You keep listening for the similarities. Don't listen for the differences. You can always find differences. Listen for the similarities. And I hope you find them, and I hope you get what I've gotten in this life and keep on trudging that road to happy destiny. God bless and thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.